Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on DogWorksRadio.com. You can also search for us over on iTunes with the same name, Dog Works Radio, as well as social media. So just search that same name for everything, and you can find us there. And while you are over on iTunes, be sure you leave us a review and some comments. That helps us out not only with rankings, but for what you guys like to hear. And calling in from, I assume, sunny California is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great here, Robert. It is, unfortunately, it's approximately a million degrees here. We've had a huge warm front with hot Santa Ana winds the past few days. I'm hoping it's going to cool down, but it has been insanely hot.
And it's in the middle of fall, so do you guys ever get a reprieve at all? I mean, what, is it any different on Christmas Day, or is it just shorts and T-shirts all the time?
You know, we do have in December and January, it's actually rather nice. It's usually in the daytime highs in the 60s, and then at night it gets a little bit colder. But, yeah, we pretty much, I always like to say it's strange that there is a professional hockey team in Los Angeles where it never gets cold enough for water to freeze.
Right. Well, I guess that's the same as having a hockey team in the Phoenix area as well. So I guess it's a good time to fly up to Alaska, enjoy some of our winter weather. Hopefully we do have some snow. And we're going to talk about the Iditarod today and how we can follow the dogs along the trail, not necessarily as fans, but as the organizers themselves, how they keep track of well over 1,000 dogs on the race at any given time. But before we jump into that, Alex, do you have any mushing news that you want to mention, any updates that you've came across in the last couple of weeks?
Well, I think the big story that I noticed is Lance Mackey, four-time Iditarod champ. Lance Mackey announced this week that he was withdrawing from the 2017 race to concentrate on health issues. In a subsequent post, his partner or his girlfriend had said that there's nothing particular that has happened and he's not doing poorly. It's just he's trying to concentrate on really getting himself back up closer to 100%. Longtime listeners know that Lance has had a lot of health issues and health problems, some of which date back to his cancer diagnosis and treatment, which is, I think, going back about 12 or 13 years back. There have been some problems with that. Every year that in the past few years when he's raced, he's had problems. He's had a lot of problems with the cold. He is this year going to take a year off and really try to get himself up to 100% so that he can be much more competitive with his dog team, which he describes as already being very competitive.
And as you mentioned, Alex, last year he did scratch, I believe it was in Galena, and the year before, that's 2014, it was the year that he had a heck of a time there on that alternate route that they had when they started in Fairbanks, and his brother Jason Mackey helped him along the trail, and they sort of mushed into Nome together, and I believe it was his brother that won the Sportsmanship Award because of that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. People who are in or near Skagway, our pal Cindy Godby, who's a good friend of Lance's, is putting on a benefit screening of the Lance Mackey documentary, The Great Alone, which is going to go to a fund to help with Lance's medical expenses. So if you're in the area, go and check that out, which I believe is coming up in the next couple of weeks. I'm not exactly sure what the date is.
Right. And just a quick note to our local listeners here in the Matsu Valley and Anchorage area, the Chugiak Dog Mushers Association Speedy Glass Dog Derby, who we talked about last week here on the show, is going to be happening next weekend, December 8th and 9th, there at the Chugiak Dog Mushers Association in Beach Lake Park. We talked to Deborah Summers last week, and you can hear all about that over on our dogworksradio.com. Anything else, Alex, before we jump into the topic?
That's all I've got right at the moment. As always, if people have news or questions, they should definitely send that to us, and we will cover it on the next show.
Right, and we are going to talk about how we track the dogs along the trail. But before we jump into that, you were talking about Lance withdrawing. I believe I read on that same post on Iditarod's page that they only have 54 mushers scheduled or signed up so far to race in next year's race. Remember last year, Alex, we had a very large field. Do you have any?
Yeah, we had 85 last year.
Wow, so 31 more.
Yeah.
Do you have any comment on that? What do you think's the reason for such a smaller field? That's one of the smallest fields that we've had in the last 4 or 5 years, I guess. That's an interesting statistic for me that, you know, last year was such a large group, this year is such a small one.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things. There's still plenty of time for people to sign up. So it seems likely that we will have probably, my guess would be, somewhere between 60 and 70 mushers when the race starts. But it's still a pretty significant drop. And I think part of the reason is, as we discussed a few weeks back, the Iditarod Trail Committee raised the entry fee fairly substantially. And so it is just a lot more expensive to enter the Iditarod in 2017 than it was in 2016 and certainly in past years. So I would think that has probably given some people pause and has made them think about whether this is really something that they want to do. Maybe there are some mushers who might have run the race if the fees had remained the same who are going to take a year off and then come back and do it in 2018. But I've got to think that the financial aspect of increasing the entry fee had something to do with that.
And, you know, we are in a bit of a financial crisis up here in Alaska, as folks that listen to this show probably have heard that oil has dropped quite a bit. Our annual PFD, which is a check that we get for being Alaskan residents, was cut in half by our governor, so it's only going to be about $1,000. I know a lot of mushers use that PFD check to sign up for the smaller races like the Northern Lights or the Testamina or Copper Basin or whatever. That could come into play as well. And I have several friends that are set net fishermen, not only in the Bethel area, you know, western Alaska, but also down Kasilof, Kenai area. And they had a real terrible time this past year with their catch. So they did not receive the income that they are usually getting for that. And all those folks that I know down there that are friends are also mushers. So that might come into play as well. And, of course, with the economy being a little bit bad here in Alaska, you know, other jobs are leaving as well. You know, construction isn't booming as it was years ago. And, you know, we've talked about this several times, Alex. A lot of mushers, Iditarod mushers in particular, they earn all of their money in the off season, in the spring, summer, and early fall. And if that work just isn't there, it makes signing up for these very expensive races, not only for entries, but all of the associated costs, almost unobtainable sometimes when that work just isn't there.
Yeah, Yeah, you know, we're used to thinking of the economy as being kind of a the same everywhere, but it's really very, very different in different parts of the country. And traditionally, Alaska has kind of lagged the lower 48 by a year or two in terms of economic activity. But so that might be part of it. I think things are finally in California starting to look good after 5 or 6 years of very, very, very depressed economic activity. But as you mentioned, a lot of the economic activity in Alaska is tied to oil. And so when the price of oil drops, that is a very, very significant thing for the state.
That it is. So hopefully everything works out. I know it usually does find a way to balance itself, and everything will be okay. We just got to worry about Mother Nature next. That is one of those things that we cannot control no matter how much or how little money we have. So hopefully that she comes around and does her thing, and everything is okay on that front. So let's jump into today's topic. Alex, we're talking about how we track sled dogs on the race, not only in the Iditarod, but also the Yukon Quest. What do you have for us to get started?
So just to throw out a few numbers, last year, and as we mentioned, it likely will be a little bit smaller field this year, but last year there were 85 dog teams. So since each dog team can start with 16 dogs, that's almost 1,400 dogs. But there's actually more dogs than that the race keeps track of, because each team can bring 20 dogs to the vet check, which is a few days before the race starts. So if you have 85 teams, you're potentially, as the Iditarod organization, looking to keep track of 1,700 different dogs.
Wow.
And that is a large, large number. And the way that Iditarod keeps track of them, and most other dog races do, is that all of the dogs, first of all, are microchipped. And the microchip is the same kind of microchip that a lot of dogs and cats and other pets get, which is a little tiny computer chip that's put in biocompatible material and basically injected under the skin of the animal. So it's something that will be put usually around the shoulder blades, and it's a painless thing that can be done very easily by a vet. Each of these microchips has a unique number that it's programmed with, and there is a reader. There's a reader that goes over the skin that picks up very, very faint amounts of radio signals that are sent out by the chip, and the reader can read the number associated with the chip. So every dog that is entered into Iditarod, and I believe in all of the major races, is required to have a chip. And if the dog has a chip, then the vets, when they do the vet check, can just read the chip. If the dog doesn't already have a chip, they give the dog a new chip, which is just injected into it under the skin. And it's very, very rare, but there are some times where the chip will, the way I've heard it described is wander, but where the chip sort of gets loose from where it is and is taken in the blood system or goes through the muscles to a different area and can't be read. And I saw in 2010 and 2011 there were one or two dogs who already had been chipped but had to be given second chips because the chips couldn't be read. So the Iditarod requires that each dog have a chip in it that can be read. And you know, if you are just listening and you have a dog who's a pet, you can have your pet chipped, and then even if the dog runs away and doesn't have a collar, as long as they have the chip, that can be identified, the dog can be identified and traced back to you. It's less of a problem with Iditarod dogs that they would run away and get lost, but this is a unique way that each of the dogs can be identified.
And just a little bit of a PSA regarding those chips for your pets. If you do get that chip done at the vet, which is a very common procedure, usually costs less than $30, make sure you fill out that form and send it in to the company that that offers that database. It doesn't do you any good to have the chip if you have not registered your dog, and more importantly, if you move, change addresses, contact info, whatever, make sure that you do contact that company and keep your records up to date. It doesn't do you any good if your dog is found, and even if you've registered that chip in Florida, that chip will still be on file when you move, say, to Alaska. But if it has that Florida address and you're no longer there, it's very difficult to get that dog back. Also, regarding that chip, Alex, a pretty interesting close-to-home story. We have an old dog named Ringo who has ran Iditarods and Yukon Quests for years, but we are trying to track down his history. And one of my Facebook friends who runs a sled dog sanctuary up here is trying to track down the origins of this dog. We know he was ran with one of the Kadzal boys in the early 2000s, and it's my understanding he was on, this dog Ringo was on the cover of Alaska Magazine in the early 2000s. But we're trying to track down Ringo's history, try to find an exact age, because as you know, and I've said this a few times on the show, when you get one of these rescued dogs or placed dogs from another kennel, almost all they're either 3, 6, or 9. So depending on the musher and what they know about the history, your dog is always going to be either 3, 6, or 9 years old when they get them. So I always find that interesting how every dog in the kennel always starts out at 6.
Yeah. And, you know, just to continue a little bit more with the whole idea of having the chip, generally speaking, when you get the chip implanted, usually the vets will charge you one fee, which covers the it's basically like giving the animal a shot. So it covers the shot, which puts the chip inside the body, and it also covers the registration fee. And then, as you said, you have to fill out the paperwork and all of that. It's a one-time registration fee. So there's no, you don't have to pay every year. You pay once, and then anytime someone gets the number, they can check who that animal belongs to. And as you mentioned, of course, it's very important to fill that paperwork in. And if you have a change of address, or you or the animal changes to have a different owner, it's very important that you update that information. There are a couple of companies that do that have the databases for the chips, and I believe they all have 800 numbers and are available 24 hours a day, but the information has to be kept updated if it's going to be useful to anyone.
So let's talk about the most prominent way that these dogs are tracked on Iditarod and on the Quest. Every musher will receive a bag of little name tags, and on the name tag is the Iditarod or Yukon Quest number for that year. So it'll say, 44 or 36 or whatever the year is for that. And then on the other side, it will have a number and a letter. So for example, if you are starting in position number 3, it will say, 3A, 3B, 3C, 3D, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what that means is you put these tags on your dogs as if you would do a identification tag for your pet dog, and that dog is tracked by that number throughout the entire race. So every time a dog goes into a checkpoint and is dropped or vet checked or anything, that dog 3D or 3C or whatever is kept track of by this tag. And these tags happen to become quite the souvenir for mushing fans. I know a lot of mushers will use those as as goodie bag stuffers for fundraisers and for sponsors. It's always interesting to follow that along and to have that special special tag for that dog that you've sponsored along on the trail. Do you have any other info on the tag tracking system, Alex?
Yeah, I don't know if you mentioned this specifically, but among the there's the number for the year of the Iditarod or the Yukon Quest or whatever, and then the next number is the bib number. So if you have bib number 13, if you choose bib number 13, your dogs will be 13A, 13B,
right,
et cetera. And so that's how they are identified. And then whenever a dog is dropped on the trail at one of the checkpoints, they are listed by the tag number, and there's drop dog paperwork that will go with the dog to when it's returned back to Anchorage. And I don't believe that the chips of the dogs are read at every checkpoint if dogs are dropped, just because I'm not sure that they have the equipment to do that at every checkpoint. But when the dogs come back to Anchorage, the tags are double checked and the chips are double checked, just to make sure that the correct dog is identified and gets back to the correct owner.
Right. Also, those tags, I find it really comical that some mushers will keep the tags on the dogs for several years. I've seen several Iditarod dogs that will have four or five or six of these tags on their collar, thinking of past jewelry or whatever. So I find that's pretty interesting as well. Some other tracking mechanisms, Alex, it's becoming more and more common for race-giving organizations to make sure that all dogs have a name of the musher on the collar. I know that's becoming more common, as well as reflective tape, both on the collars and on the harnesses. I know that was that could become a very big deal in the next couple of years in light of what happened on the trail this past year with the snow machiners not being able to see the dog teams on the trail. And in smaller races, and in particular mid-distance and sprint races, one way that they track dogs is they'll put paint on the dogs. Typically they'll put it on one of their back flanks or on their chest, and they'll use a color-coded paint on their dogs, and they'll kind of do a swish on each dog to make sure that those dogs are running in day one, day two, day three, whichever. I know the Fur Rondi does this technique where they'll paint a group of dogs, and of course that is to inhibit any type of bringing dogs in on different heats. So that's always a good way of doing it as well. Another way that they're tracking dogs these days are with different types of GPS trackers, not necessarily for race-giving organizations, but a lot of mushers are putting items on their dogs so that you can track them online. I know there's a company out there called Whistle that is sort of like a Fitbit for your dog that you can put on your dog team, and you can see how far they've ran or whatnot. And it makes for a great training tool and mileage tracking tool for your dogs. I haven't quite, pulled the trigger and bought 15 or 20 of those little trackers and put them on all of my dogs so we can track their training miles, because that's always difficult to do for training, is to make sure each dog gets tracked on the number of miles that they've gone in training each year. Alex, we have just a couple of more minutes. Anything else on tracking dogs in races and or in training?
Just very quickly, these things are becoming easier and cheaper year by year. And I know that as a fan, it would be difficult to do this, but I would so completely love to see the Iditarod figure out a way to automate this so that we could we could, in real time or close to real time, be able to see not only that, for example, Dallas Seavey has 10 dogs, but to see which dogs he has and which dogs he's dropped where.
Right.
That's always something that people who are really involved in Iditarod love following, and I think that would add a dimension to following the race that would be really, really fun.
You know, for those data nerds out there, I think that that would be a great way to figure out a way, whether it's some kind of spreadsheet or you know, something where they're doing GPS, as I mentioned with that that Fitbit type advice. On the dogs. I think that would be really cool to be able to track that, because remember, all dog mushing is about the dogs. I know we spend so much time talking about the mushers and the kennels and, you know, their sponsors and all that, but this sport would not be anything if it wasn't for those 10, 12, 14, 16 dogs out there on that line doing everything that they have to do to get from point A to point B.
Yeah. I looked up while we were talking. The Great Alone in Skagway will be at the Eagles Theater on Friday, October 14th at 7:30. So if you're around Skagway, that's where you should go.
And one other point to that, the Great Alone is also going to be shown up here in Willow at the Willow Dog Mushers Association Symposium. I believe that is this weekend. That's going to be shown on Saturday night. That is a weekend-long event where Saturday and Sunday they have talks about mushing and other dog sports. I know typically the military or the police organizations will bring out their attack dogs to do protection dogs to do their demos. They'll have cart races and demos. They'll have booths and special speakers and all sorts of things. So if you're in the area and you want to travel up to Willow, it will be at the Willow Community Center both on Saturday and Sunday. There will also be a gear swap, and you can see the movie, The Great Alone, Saturday night. I'm not sure, but we'll check on it. But I think Lance and his brother, Jason, who was also in the movie, are going to be there for that event for a Q&A afterwards. You can find out more about that on the Willow Dog Mushers Association Facebook page. Alex, anything else before we go?
Real quickly, I just wanted to mention one book that I've been reading that is really fantastic. It's a collection of short stories called Dodger Blue Will Fill Your Soul, written by a guy named Brian Allen Fierro, born in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles area, now lives up in Anchorage where he is a firefighter and paramedic. And it's just an absolutely amazing, wonderful book. So check that out.
And, you know, we have not done our recommendations in a while. And just quickly off the top of my head, something that we've been watching is the miniseries from the Stephen King story, 11/22/63. It's about the Kennedy assassination. I know it was available on Hulu earlier this year. And I believe it's going to be on Netflix pretty soon. But we got it on Amazon on Blu-ray for like $10. Definitely a cool miniseries, especially if you like Stephen King. Definitely check it out. It's about an 8-episode show and something that you will just kind of kick back and enjoy.
Yeah, I read the book that it's based on. I haven't seen the miniseries yet, but the book is amazing. So I can't wait to see that too.
Very good. All right, Alex, we're just about out of time. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.